All right, we're going to talk now about counseling people who are taking medicine. I had one of you come up and tell me that for starting out by saying that I didn't want to be critical of people who took medicine, I surely did a good job of beating all over medicine for the hour. And I really did not want you to come away thinking that. What I wanted you to understand when I told you about the journal articles and the chemical imbalance theory and all that, what I really wanted you to understand is that you're free to fire at will. I think people who do counseling are sometimes inhibited or afraid to try to deal with the behavior that they see in front of them because of the claims by the counselee that they behave that way because they are obligated to by a chemical imbalance. And if you know that the chemical imbalance is a theory and it's not real, then that gives you great freedom, doesn't it? Yeah, it does. And that's my point. With regard to people taking medicine, I don't pay that much attention to it. And the reason why I don't is because it's not the goal. It's not the important thing. You know, you can get yourself hung up on the rock of something that's not important and miss the important thing. Now, the question that let's have a word of prayer before we start, all right? Heavenly Father, God, we come before you and I thank you for the salvation that you've given us, Lord. And I thank you that you love us, and I praise you for your word. And God, I praise you for the Holy Spirit that lives inside our hearts and enables us to understand it. God, I ask now that you'd open our hearts to the word and open our minds so that we can learn how to help people who come to counseling and are taking medicine. And God, I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Counseling people who are taking medicine. And the question is, first off, is medicine necessary as we counsel people? We'd answer that question by first defining the difference between medicine and psychiatry with regard to disease. I have a lecture that I call Disease or Not that I do in the other group and that I've done in time over the past couple of years. And it looks exactly at the issue of disease, disorder, and syndrome. It's actually a language question more than anything else. What do you call a disease? What do you call a disorder? There is a difference between what psychiatry calls a disease and what those of us who are in the general practice or the more general practice of medicine would call a disease. In medicine, there's a definite organic cause for disease, and there are definite organic causes for behavior problems. We talked about those in the lecture, I think, last night, didn't we? Yeah, I think so. Or maybe this morning. It was this morning we did. I get a little blurry about this, moving through time zones and everything. But yes, we've already dealt with things like Cushing's disorder and hypothyroidism. Whenever an organic cause is found of the disease, it's given a medical diagnosis. The example I like best is pica, and that's when your serum iron drops below a certain level and your hemoglobin drops, below 7 or something like that. Some people will start eating strange things. Children will eat wallboard and dirt. Pregnant women will eat whole bags of carrots at a time. They'll sit down and eat a whole bag of carrots at a sitting, whole gallons of ice cream at one sitting. And when you correct their iron and raise their hemoglobin back up, they quit. Some people chew ice for the same reason, and they chew ice so much that they'll break their teeth, they'll crack their teeth. And when you correct the anemia, the desire to chew the ice, eat the carrots, eat the ice cream goes away. Now, we don't look at those people and say that they have ice eater's disease, do we? No, not at all. We say they have anemia. And if you correct it, the behavior, which is bizarre, goes away, the pica. The diagnosis primarily describes the disease in the body rather than the symptoms. We call it anemia, not ice eater's disease. To qualify as an illness, the condition in question must show damage to the body's physical tissue, which in this case meant that the hemoglobin was down below 7. Psychiatry, on the other hand, approaches disease differently. And in psychiatry, the diagnoses are made on the basis of behavior and not the reason for the behavior or pathologic changes which would cause the behavior. Various theories are proposed to account for the behavior. We started with Freud, went to Skinner for behaviorism. Today, the big theory, of course, is the medical chemical imbalance theory, which is used to tell or explain to people why they act like they do. The difference between the medical and the psychiatric diagnosis is this. Medicine, you have a disease, and it leads to symptoms or behavior, and in psychiatry, you have symptoms or behavior which lead to a theory as to their cause. Now, why do people take medicine? Again, as we said in the last hour, people who live by their feelings are often those who take medicine. I can tell you about this 40-something-year-old female. This is a real story. This is not a composite, and the reason why I can tell you is because the lady told me I can. I can tell anybody I want to. It's her life, and she wants me to share it with you. When she came to counseling, she was starving to death. She carried the diagnosis of anorexia nervosa. She was morbidly depressed. She would sit there across from me and talk to me, and she would answer her questions somewhat like a 486 computer with a 250 meg hard drive that was full. All of you remember 486 computers? Didn't you feel so empowered when you got it? And wasn't that hard drive, which was as big as a box, wasn't that amazing? Yeah, until you were doing Word or Word Perfect and you needed to do spell check and your hard drive was a little full. And you could hit that button for spell check and you could go to the bathroom and wash your hands and then go to the kitchen and make you a sandwich and get a Coke. And then you could come back and it would still be doing it, wouldn't it? Yeah, just take forever. A 20-page paper, spell check was a long wait. And that's how the lady talked to me. Doesn't that just drive you crazy when I do that? Can you just get on with it? And the reason why she talked that way was because she didn't have enough sugar left in her brain to run it. She had starved herself down to the point where she could barely communicate. Now, wouldn't you think that me being a doctor, that I would recognize that someone like that needs to be in a hospital? Wouldn't you think? Wouldn't you think that I would think that she needed a doctor who'd taken care of lots of people who had anorexia nervosa? Wouldn't you think? Wouldn't you? That's a trap, isn't it? You can tell by now. Well, she'd already been there. You know, she'd been hospitalized 3 times. She had a psychiatrist who met her well. I'm certainly not anti-doctor. Why would I be that? No. She had a psychiatrist who met her well, and she was already on medicine. She was on 3 of them, matter of fact. And the only reason why she was in my counseling room was because her sister was desperate. They were watching this woman die. And everything known to modern medicine and mankind was being done for her, and nothing was helping her. And that's why she came to see me. Her sister, who was a registered nurse, spent the first hour listening to me and thought I was nuts. Certifiably, she thought I was crazy. She only came back the second hour because they had absolutely no place else to go. They were at the end. And she would sit there and look at me and say, "Couldn't you just let me die?" And then she'd alternate that with saying, "I just want to feel better. Doesn't God want me to feel better?" That's what she'd say to me. Her whole life was being conducted by her feelings. All right. Now, remember what I told you about making sure what a person means when they say, "I just want to feel better"? Yeah, this is the lady who originated that idea for me. I finally figured out what it was that would make her feel better. She wanted her ex-husband back. That's what she wanted. She wanted her ex-husband back. We couldn't figure out why. He was the ex. I mean, she told us about him, and we, why would you want him back? He was unsaved. He was a drunk. He beat her. He beat her kids, and she wanted him back. And he was married again. He was married to some other poor wretch. And you know, we just sat there and shook our heads. Why in the world do you want him back? And she wanted him back so badly that she had decided that if she just lost a lot of weight, that, well, she'd get skinny again, and he would be attracted to her, and he would leave his wife and come back to her. The only problem with her calculation was that she set the weight that she needed to lose, about 25 pounds, on the other side of dead. And that was where she was headed. I just want to feel better. Didn't mean I wanted to feel better at all. It meant that she had an amazing idol of the heart, one which she was willing to lay her life down on the altar for. I want my husband back. All right, so she was leaving by feeling. She didn't see God in a Romans 8:28 and 29 sense. She couldn't see that her husband leaving might be God actually working in her life, you know? We needed to, I thought for a while we had to teach her that song from South Pacific, one about gonna wash that man right out of my hair. Yeah, I mean, she needed to sing that song instead of the one that she was singing. She didn't see God in the trial. And she claimed that the real solution to her problem was to change the way she felt. That was what she consistently told me. She didn't know how to use the Bible to deal with life. She was a Christian. We nailed her down on that. That was a real redeeming thing. That was instrumental in the fact that she would recover. The other instrumental fact is that she had a sister who loved her. A sister who was a believer. The sister who was the nurse who came with her to almost every visit. Which was good for the sister. Who thought I was crazy. She, of course, had been told that she had a chemical imbalance and that was the cause of her problem. We savaged that idea in the last hour so we don't have to do it again. This is a pictorial representation of the chemical imbalance. A lack of norepinephrine or dopamine or serotonin at that space between your nerve endings and your brain cells inside your head. The reason why no one knows what the appropriate level of serotonin is in a human head, and the reason why they never will, is because you can't get anybody to volunteer for the study. I mean, that's serious. I mean, the only way that you can find out what the appropriate level of dopamine in anybody's head is to drill a lot of holes and sample it. And it's not going to happen. It's not an ethical study. You know, the study that proved that serotonin raised, or that Prozac raised serotonin in brain cells, or was used to infer it, was done with the monkeys, as I said earlier. I'll tell you something else about that study when Eli Lilly got its approval, and that was that they did five studies. That's another thing that we've found out, is that drug companies and journals don't print negative articles. They only print positive articles. Eli Lilly did five studies to get approval for Prozac. Three of them showed that the drug did not work. Two of them did. Guess which two they gave to the FDA, which is the minimal number of studies that you have to have in order to get a drug approved. They didn't give them the two negative ones or the three negative ones. They gave them the two positive ones. Now, you and I would have said, 3 out of 5. This drug doesn't work. They just showed up the positive studies. Okay, the chemical imbalance is a term used for a theory, as we said in the last hour. And the chemical imbalance is a theory, not a fact. An improvement of feelings as a result of the chemical doesn't prove that there was a chemical imbalance, nor does it prove that that chemical imbalance was related to the feelings that were there. That's the important thing to keep in mind. Some folks would ask, maybe sinful behavior has produced a chemical imbalance and medication is needed to restore it. And my response to that would be, what's the result of regeneration? What happens when the Holy Spirit lives inside a person's heart? Sinful behavior obviously can make people feel badly. The only problem with trying to say that sinful behavior causes a chemical imbalance that can be corrected with the use of medication is that, well, I mean, we don't even know if there is a chemical imbalance in anybody's head. So how would we know if they were living? How would you do any kind of study that would prove it? You know, you'd have to line people up who were committed sinners and then get them to be part of a study. So you know, there's no way to prove that statement, either one way or the other. Research studies haven't proven the chemical imbalance theory to be a fact, and we looked at research which said quite the opposite. Now the question comes down, what if future research reveals the theory to be actual fact, or they find some other physical cause for the behavior? And my response to that is that a lot of our behavior is already known to be hardwired in. Isn't that true? Let's see. Yes. When people are born, ladies are born, there are things that are going to happen at a predetermined time in their life which changes their behavior. Yeah, I'm being warned out here, aren't I? Yes, right. Women don't have mood swings, do they? Let's see if I can start a fight here. Right. So at any rate, before you're born, before the foundation of the earth, God created women to have ovaries, and ovaries make estrogen, and estrogen results in behavior, does it not? Yeah, it does. Sure shooting. Are you responsible for that behavior as a woman? Yeah, absolutely. Are you responsible how you respond to the things that happen to you as the month goes by? Are you? Absolutely. You're responsible to respond in a biblical way, are you not? Yes, you are. Now, let's turn the sword and swing the other way. Before guys are born, is there anything that's determined before they're born that's going to result later in life in behavior? And the women all say, yes, really loud, don't they? Yeah, they're getting in here right now, yeah. Yes, they will. Things will wake up in their lives somewhere between 11 and 12 years old, and suddenly they will start acting in strange ways. Right, ladies? Yes, they will. Now, tell me this. Just because that behavior is actually hardwired in, are men supposed to be responsible for how they respond to those changes in their lives? Yes. Do we give rapists a free pass just because they're men and they have testicles? No. Do we hold men and women both responsible for their sexual behavior? Yes. Do you see how I've just answered the question? What if they ever decide that depression has some physical basis or something like that? Does that mean that we're still responsible before God to respond to the way that we feel in a biblical way? And the answer will be then just the same. Yes, absolutely. All right. Now, there are true chemical imbalances in the body, but they are present. When they are present, the condition is no longer labeled as a chemical imbalance, but it's given a medical disease label. And the question is, wouldn't it be good to use medication to control bizarre behavior to calm a person down so that you could counsel him? I would say that's a plus-minus question. If you're dealing with someone who's psychotic, who thinks that they're Jesus Christ, and they've been told by Satan to kill their children, yeah, I think you're going to end up medicating that person, and I think it's a very reasonable and logical thing to do. Do I think that always works out well, you know, as far as, you know, what the final outcome is? And my answer would be, well, it really doesn't always work as well as you might think. And we had a 13-year-old girl who claimed to be having episodes of hallucinations and psychosis. She would jump out of the family van as it was going down the road. She would try to be physically abusive towards her family, and actually had spent a couple of passes in a psychiatric hospital where her mother said she just seemed to get worse and worse every time she went. And actually the best thing that ever happened to her was one day she decided to spit on a policeman. Because you know what that got her? Got her cuffed and arrested. And they didn't take her back to the country club psychiatric ward that she had been in. They took her over to a different hospital where they sat her on a chair, made her stare at the wall and said, you know, we just talked to your mom and dad. They seem pretty normal. What's wrong with you? And there she sat for a really long time until she got the drift that that was where she was going to be sitting for a really long time if she continued to behave that way. And you know what they found out? that her allegations of having been raped, her protestations about having hallucinations, they were all fabricated. Every last one of them. And understandably so, then when they treated her with medication, she really didn't improve because there was nothing to treat, and all she had to bear with them were the side effects of the medication. So I would tell you that not always does it work out very well. Sometimes there are indications for the use of medication, but it's not always a clear-cut thing. Questions to ask when a physical problem like chemical imbalance is allegedly producing emotional or behavior problems. How do you tell the difference between a real honest-to-goodness medical disease or a psychiatric label? And you would ask what tests were run. And were those tests blood tests, as we talked about earlier, physical exam tests or CAT scans or things like that, or were they pencil and paper psychological self-rating scale type tests? Then you would also want to ask them, how is the medicine supposed to work to help you? You know, if they tell you, well, they tell me that if I take this medicine, my thyroid level will rise and I'll be able to talk faster in public and get my lecture done, then you know that you're dealing with a medical problem. If they say that it's going to correct a chemical imbalance in my head and then I'll be a happier person, then you know you're dealing with a psychiatric label disorder. Now, then you also need to ask them how the doctor said that the medication would correct the problem that they faced. Counselees also take medicines because they believe that drugs help them to feel better. Of course, for my 40-year-old anorectic, that was not the case. Her medication didn't seem to help her at all. The Bible instead teaches us that the feelings that we have are an outgrowth of how we think and how we act. You know, as we said earlier from John 13:17, now that you know these things, happy are you if you do them. So our feelings grow out of our behavior and our thinking. And this is how it looks. If you want me to draw you a picture. All right. You have a circumstance or a problem. You look at it. You assess it. You decide that it's either the greatest catastrophe that you've ever faced, or you decide that it's a real opportunity to grow and change and become more like Christ. Out of that response grows feelings, how you're going to feel about it. If you view it as a catastrophe, then you'll be worried, fearful, afraid, angry. If you view it as something that God has allowed to come into your life, you can have peace instead. And from that then grows what behavior you'll decide to do. Either you'll respond to it as a catastrophe or you'll respond to it in a way that would be biblically appropriate. Everybody have that? Boom, moving on. Problems, of course, responded to in an unbiblical manner produce unpleasant feelings, which is exactly what we'd expect. The way of the transgressor is hard. Yes. There is no peace for the wicked, says my God. So you have an unbiblical response. A problem that leads to an unbiblical response. You have bad feelings as a result. The bad feelings lead to more problems and to other behavior which create problems as well. It sort of becomes a circular thing. It's the Romans 1 toilet drain. You ever read Romans 1? Yeah, and why as you're reading it, it always reminds me of the toilet. You know, things swirl around, 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 boom, finally go down the drain. And that's what people are like when they are pursuing sin, you know, as described by Paul in Romans 1. Feeling-oriented people use their bad feelings as the reason for their inability to function. My counselee wasn't working. She wouldn't sleep in her own bed at night. You know why she wouldn't sleep in her own bed at night? Anybody want to guess? Yes, she'd wake up alone. That's right. And so she would sleep on the couch. That was one of the first things I made her do, sleep in her own bed at night. She didn't want to wake up alone. She was on disability, which, you know, as a taxpayer in the state of Indiana, I felt really compelled to see to it that she got fixed so that she could get off the tax roll. When I first saw her, she wasn't going to church. She wasn't reading her Bible. She wasn't praying. She had no Christian service obligations or activities. She was doing all the things that we would expect someone in her position to be doing at the time, along with not eating. Medication is used to reduce the bad feelings, making the person feel better and thus helping him function better. At least that's the theory. You take that second cascade and you stick a pill in it. And at this point, it is still unknown how these medicines make people feel better when they do. If you don't believe that, just go read the PDR and get down to mechanism of action. When you get down to the mechanism of action, it is thought. It is assumed. It might. And that's the kind of terms they use. They say very plainly, it is unknown how it works, how they work. When the person feels better, if they do, because of the improved feelings, they'll get the false impression that their problems have been solved. And even though their feelings may improve, it does not get to the heart of their problem. New drugs are continually developed because of the failures and side effects of the old ones. I can tell you this, the real drive behind new drugs today is patent expiration dates. You know, Prozac used to be the be-all and end-all of all medications in the 1980s, and then the patent expired, and now Cymbalta is the be-all and end-all of medication. You can see those Cymbalta advertisements in print and on TV telling you that depression causes pain and we're going to fix it. Now, I would tell you that medication is not needed or even particularly helpful in biblical counseling. There's no particular reason to send people to the doctor to get them on medication. I always do make one of my first assignments is to send, if a person hasn't been to a doctor in a year when they come in for counseling and they are depressed or are struggling with something, my first assignment will be that you need to go to the doctor. But I always send this cautionary statement. You know, when you go to the doctor, you tell him, Doc, I'm here because my counselor wants to know if there's a medical problem that I have that is causing me to feel this way. He doesn't particularly think I need to be on medicine. Because if you don't send him in saying that, what'll happen before the 15 minutes is up is, you know, they'll have a prescription written out and they'll be on medication before they come back and see you. And that is not particularly helpful. You know, most of these medicines, it's always kind of funny, you know, for the folks who I've written them for, they'll come back in a few days and tell me how much better they feel. Well, you know, if you read the descriptions of the drugs, they're not even supposed to work for 2 weeks, you know, but they start taking them and feel better the next day. Obviously, the placebo effect really helps in that regard. All right. When there's no proven organic cause for the behavior, we should respond to it with the scriptures. Now, what counseling principles ought we to use? Well, we need to gather data, as we said in the first hour, give them that first 30 minutes. You need to get information which applies to the time in the person's life when the medication was started. What was going on when this whole process started for them? You need to learn to find out what in those situations were unpleasant for them. You know, for my anorectic lady, it was simply being without her husband. Then you need to learn how the counselee responded to them. Like my anorectic lady responded to it with worry, anger, and fear, and with starving herself. You know, what was the goal of each response? Always ask people, don't ask people why. Now, you know, when I first started practicing medicine, they told me in pediatrics, don't ask a teenager why. And I always thought, well, why not? But then I did ask a few teenagers why, and I understood. You know, because what does a teenager say when you ask them why? But they don't even say the words. They just go, oh. Right? You've heard that. Oh. Do you know what adults say when you ask them, you know, if you're looking the guy right in the eye and asking, well, why did you commit adultery? You know what he's going to say? Oh. Yeah, the same adolescent, teenage sort of answer. So if you really want to find out something about it, ask them, what was your goal? What was your goal in doing that? You can ask children that, you can ask adults that, and you'll get lots more information. Then you want to ask the counselor, how has the medication helped with each of these situations that they're taking the medicine for? You need to build involvement with the counselee and give hope. Don't criticize the counselee for following the advice of his physician. Now, why would I tell you that? Well, because it may very well be the case that the doctor told him to come and see you. I have one lady who attends my church that I counsel with on and off. And the reason why she came to church was because her psychologist told her she needed to. Always wanted to meet the guy, whoever it was. I haven't run into too many psychologists who tell people that they need to go to church. She came to church and found the Lord, accepted Christ, became a Christian, and her whole life was revolutionized. So don't be critical of the counselee for following the advice of their physician. You instead need to teach biblical principles that apply to the problems and the presence of the bad feelings that the counselee has. Now, you know, this counselee that I'm telling you about is the lady that I generated that statement I told you last night. I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe. She is the first person I ever said that to. And now I tell every counselee who walks in the door that. And I tell them that set of four verses I told you about last night, starting with 2 Corinthians 5:9 and going to Matthew 22:37 and John 14:21 and John 13:17. But that was the first principle that she had to learn. She had to be willing to say, I want to glorify God with my life more than I want to breathe, which meant then that she loved God more than getting her ex-husband back. You know, that was the first thing that we had to teach her. Then we had to help her change her habits. We taught her from the Old Testament that she had to give up on her husband. You know, the Bible says that if someone is divorced and they have gone on to marry, they can't go back. They can't divorce their current mate and go back and marry the old one. That's denied by the scriptures. What commandment do you think that we worked on first with her? How about thou shalt not kill? Now you begin to understand anorexia. Yes, anorexics are some of the most selfish people on the face of the earth. You know, why do I say that? Because everything about them is aimed at them. Everything about them is about them. How they look, how they relate to other people. And their whole life revolves around controlling that. And it doesn't make any difference how what they do absolutely disrupts and destroys the lives of people all around them. It's all about them. That has to change. So we took her to that first commandment, thou shalt not kill. And we made her fill out menus, eat, bring back the menus. Her sister held her accountable. These are all things which are very much contrary to what you hear people say about anorexia, that anorectics need to become accountable to themselves and so on and so forth. We held her accountable to do the things that she needed to do, and that first was to eat. Then we made her sleep in her own bed, told her she had to go to church. According to Hebrews 10:25, she couldn't forsake the assembling of ourselves together. She said she didn't feel like it. I said, I don't care. And I don't. And the reason why I didn't was because I know that if she was going to feel bad on Sunday morning, she could feel just as bad in church as she could at home. And I routinely tell people that. I'll look at them and say, you do not have a communicable disease. You're not going to kill anybody by being there. You'll be much better off sitting in the company of God's people on Sunday morning than sitting in bed feeling bad about yourself and watching some TV preacher. And that's the truth of the matter. So she had to go to church. She had to pray and read her Bible. We had held her accountable to do that. I made her read When People Are Big and God Is Small. I commend that to your attention for folks who struggle with self-image and self-esteem. She hated the book. And the reason why she hated it was because God was small in her life and she was big. And that had to change. We made her get a job. We made her get a job because she was a user. And at the time when we started, the only job she could get was working in a family business because no one else would hire her. So she got this job with her relative. It was a donut shop. Yeah. The anorectic lady went to work in the donut shop. That's right. We made her get a job because the scripture says if a person won't work, they won't eat. That's right. She needed a job. We made her give up on her husband. Then we made her do Christian service. Christian service. You should assign it on about the second visit that you have, the second session that you have with any counselee. And it has to be for, and these are important things, someone who's worse off than they are. It needs to be for someone, not cleaning the windows at church. The windows at church need cleaned, but that won't do. It has to be for a person who's worse off than they are, because that will get their nose out of their own belly button, won't it? Yeah, make them interact with people who are worse off than they are. So someone who's worse off than they are, it cannot be a relative, because there's always secondary gain in taking care of your mother-in-law. So, not a relative, someone who cannot pay you and from whom you take nothing. And you must do it for 2 hours a week, every week, for the rest of your life. And that's what I assigned to her. It was the little old lady thing. That's what I always tell people. Little old ladies are great. You know, go take care of the little old ladies, the widows in your church. And she would do things for a little old lady who lived across the street. It became instrumental for her because she eventually got a job doing home health care for little old ladies. Yes. So we taught her principles that changed her behavior. Now, my primary goal, it was not to get her off medication. My goal was to change her life so that she wouldn't need medication. I refused to talk to her about medicine. And a lot of people want to come and talk to me because I'm one of the doctors who counsels. And the first question they want to ask is, can I quit taking my medicine? And I'll look at them and say, no, no. Most of these medicines have withdrawal side effects. If you tell people to quit taking them, one, you're violating the laws of the state of Oregon or California, wherever you live, because you're practicing medicine without a license. And two, they'll have withdrawal symptoms and they'll feel bad and they'll blame you. So just ignore it. That's what I do. I told her she could quit the substance nicotine anytime she wanted to. And she would gain weight as a result. Biblical goal is to become more like Christ through the problems rather than feeling better. To become more like Christ through daily problems means to handle or to respond to them in a way that pleases God. And that was going to be the goal for my anorectic lady. Might never get her husband back. No, I could guarantee she wasn't going to get her husband back. He was married. And she should be glad she wasn't going to get him back. Her life was going to turn out tons better. You know, sometimes when God tells you no, it's a great thing. I can remember watching this preacher one night praying on television, and he was really earnest about it. And this diabetic lady had called in, and he was praying for her. And he said, God, take all the sugar out of her blood. And I said, no, don't do that. She'll go into a coma. You know, sometimes when we just don't know what we're asking for. And sometimes it's really good when God tells us, no. Yeah, yeah, this lady was going to do a lot better because God told her no, she couldn't have her old husband back. You know, the Bible has promised great victory in difficult situations where change in feelings is not possible. Now, your goal is to teach the counselee how to deal with their problems biblically so that the medication becomes unnecessary. Now, you might ask, I've been counseling a person for a long time. I can't find any significant spiritual problems in their life, so isn't medication needed? And my response to that is, well, you know, when I've seen that happen, what I found is what I immediately do are two things. One is I go back to the beginning as a counselor and start over again. And the reason why is because people don't always tell you everything the first time. They may not tell you everything in the first six sessions. So if you're not making any progress, you need to circle back and start asking questions again. And you may find that they are concealing information from you that will answer the reason why that there are no apparent spiritual problems in their life. And the other is that I would send them back to the doctor as well. You know, if they haven't seen a physician for a long time, I would send them back to the doctor for sure And let the doctor also ask some more questions and make sure that there's not something physically wrong with the person, another consult. Most of the time, the questions get answered when I start asking the first questions over again. Now, what happens when it gets time for the counselee to come off medication? What are you going to do? You know, I never talked to that lady about her medicine. I saw her 12 times. That's remarkable for an anorectic if you think about it. Most people are anorectics forever, aren't they? Yeah. You have a disease, you're never going to get over this. You're going to have this the rest of your life and you're going to struggle with it. This lady didn't turn out that way. But I talked to her 12 times, and I after the first time I told her that I wasn't going to talk to her about medicine for a really long time, we just never talked about it again. There is a conclusion. I'll get to it eventually about it. What if the counselee is already on medication? Don't worry about it. Don't make it an issue. It's not the point. You know, we're not counseling people so they don't have to take Zoloft. We are counseling people so they can learn to glorify God with their lives. You know, that's what you're there for. That's what you're supposed to be doing. As a counselor, taking people off medication is not something for you to do. And your goal is to find biblical solutions to their problems while they're still taking the medicine. Now, how do you respond to the counselee when they ask or request that their medicine be discontinued? Well, you want to find out why they want to quit. A lot of people want to quit taking medicine because there are three good reasons. One is it costs money. Big reason. You know, when your medication costs you $4 a day, stopping does seem to be a compelling idea. Side effects. Most people don't like the side effects of the medication they take. And then some people are just frankly embarrassed by it all. You know, they view taking medicine as meaning that they are weak. You need to explain at that point to the counselee that you have a lot of work to do before we can talk about that question. You're going to put it off all the way to the end of counseling, and it ceases to be an issue. I can tell you this. I've only run into about two counselees in 10 years for whom taking medicine was an impediment to being in counseling. One of them was taking amphetamines by a prescription from one physician, and the psychiatrist was telling her she didn't need them, which I thought was remarkable. And when she sat there, she couldn't sit still. I mean, you know, she had hyperactivity, but her hyperactivity was being driven by the amphetamines that she was taking. And I did something that I almost never do in counseling. I looked at her and I said, "You ought to do what the psychiatrist told you. No, you should quit that, just like he told you to quit it." But that almost never happens. So you can take the issue of medication and just kind of set it off there at the back burner and get busy doing what you ought to be doing, counseling their problems. If you're convinced that towards the end of counseling that the counselee can come off the medication, then send him back to the doctor who started it. That's what I do. I have a license to practice medicine in the state of Indiana, and if someone comes into me in counseling and they're taking medicine and they want to quit it, I will have nothing to do with it. I send them back to their doctor. It's unethical for me to do anything else. And I send them back with this story. You go back to your doctor. You know, it's been almost a year now since he started you on it. And you tell him this: "Doc, I'm doing really good. You know, I've been in counseling and they've helped me learn how to approach life in a completely different way, and I feel fine. Doc, you know, I'd really like to know if I need to take this medicine the rest of my life. Would you help me arrange to wean myself off of it so I can take a vacation from this medicine and find out if it's absolutely necessary?" And if the physician is wise and if he's ethical, he will say, "Sure." And if he isn't, then they need to get a second opinion from someone else. If the doctor refuses, get a second opinion. You need to continue counseling as a form of progress reports for, I usually do that longer than 3 or 4 weeks, because most of these medicines have half-life of 2 weeks or something like that. And I'd say if you're going to get in trouble, it's going to be out 2 to 6 weeks. So you might want to tag bases with the counselee longer than that. Now, I bet you guys would like to know what happened to that anorectic lady, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you? I'll come back later. I'll tell you. I think this is my last lecture with you anyway. Well, the anorectic lady's not anorectic anymore. At this point, I think she is about 4 years out of anorexia. She ate normally, gained her weight back. By the time we were done with her, I was somewhat fearful about her outcome, as you would be with anybody who's ever been in this situation. But she had heard everything that she thought she needed to, and decided that counseling was done. I ran into her sister a year later, and with some fear and trepidation asked, well, you know, how's she doing? And the sister said, she was fine. Was eating normally, was working in the, as a home health aide at the time. The sister who thought I was crazy, she enrolled in, biblical counseling there at Lafayette, and now is an ANC certified counselor. It was good for her to come to all those sessions, wasn't it? The lady is now married. She began dating a Christian man in her church, and I think at her about 3 years, they were married. So her life actually is infinitely better because God said no, isn't it? Yeah. The other thing was that she could never have remarried the guy, even if he'd have come back. Why? Because she's a Christian and he's not. You know, you don't remarry a saved person to an unsaved person. Yeah, because they shouldn't have married him in the first place. In her job as a home health care aide, one of the first ladies she took care of was a 90-year-old woman, and the 90-year-old woman was not a Christian. That afforded her relationship with that lady afforded her the opportunity to share the gospel with her. That 90-year-old lady accepted Christ, and 2 weeks later promptly died. And a few days later, she came back to the home to pick up her equipment, you know, that her company, that they leave, I guess, the durable medical equipment. And she ran into the 90-year-old lady's family, all of whom were Christians and who were distraught at the notion that this 90-year-old woman had died and split hell wide open. And she got to share the fact that she had shared the gospel with that woman and she had accepted Christ. What an amazing blessing. At about 3 years, I was giving this lecture in our February conference up in Lafayette, and I was behind. I'm not today. I'm doing pretty good. I'm 10 minutes early. I'm going to get to answer some questions. And there was a nice young lady sitting down on the front row, but I was behind, and I was telling this story, and she was trying to get my attention because she wanted to say something. And you know how it goes when you're lecturing and you're behind and there's somebody who wants to answer a question, you look the other way. You know, you try to ignore them. Why? Well, because I need to get done, you know. And finally, she just blurted out and said, "That's my aunt." And I stood there for a moment because I knew I was going to have to ask how she was. It was like, in front of 100 people, we're going to get a progress report here. I hope it's good. And then in the next breath, she said, "She's doing fine." And then she said, "But they sold the donut shop." That's right. You know, when that lady showed up in the office, she was nearly dead. Literally nearly dead. She had received the best health care that mankind knew how to give her. And she was still nearly dead. And all I did was take the Bible out and show her what the scriptures said about how she was living. And she changed. And the lady who was dead was leading people to Christ last time I checked. Isn't that an amazing difference? You should always think about that when you're thinking about doing biblical counseling. The scriptures are powerful. And they always work when they're applied. Was there anything else about her? No, I don't think so. Okay, so it's time for questions now. What questions do you have about counseling? Oh, yes. Last time I checked, she wasn't taking any medicine. She had, at some point, decided she didn't want to take any more and just weaned herself off of it. So the last time I checked, she wasn't taking anything. And I never talked to her about it. Now, do you get the point of this lecture? The whole point of the lecture was that I counseled this lady from nearly dead to, you know, being back among the living, serving God and winning souls. And she was taking medicine most all the time, and I never talked to her about it. You can do exactly the same thing. Okay, question back there.
Could you address kids that
Yes, I could if I had an hour. No. Okay. Could I address kids on Ritalin for ADD? I have a lecture on attention deficit disorder that you can get from Sound Word. Let me say that, and then, but I'm not going to avoid the question. I do not write prescriptions for stimulant medications for anybody. I don't write Ritalin or Adderall for children. I do not write it for adults. I don't write it for children because I don't want to write it for adults. I take the position and the view, and you can disagree with me if you wish, and we can still love each other and be friends, and you don't have to come up and beat me up after the lecture's over, ADHD is not a disease, that there is no pathology associated with it that proves that it exists. And I view that the use of amphetamines in children, which are addictive substances, carry with it far more side effect risk potentials than the benefit. And so I don't do it, and I've never done it. So that's okay. His hand went up first. Yes. I write as little of narcotics for people as I possibly can. And that's a whole nother hour's worth. My view of pain medication is I don't want to leave a patient addicted to something for a short-term problem. If you don't have a broken bone and you don't have a burn, the odds of you getting Vicodin from me are close to zero. And the reason why is because it's a spectacularly addictive substance. Now, when I do write for pain medication, and I do, I use the general Norman Schwarzkopf rule, and that is always send enough troops, overwhelmingly treat the problem, and know when you're going to quit. Know when you're going to quit, and that is the most important aspect of it. And if someone walks into me and they say, I have migraine headaches and I want Vicodin, I smile and say, I don't write for any addictive substance for migraine headaches. I can treat it with lots of other things besides that. And there's too great a potential for you to become habituated to this substance for me to give it to you. If, on the other hand, they have a broken bone or a ruptured disc in their back, I, for a short period of time, will write for those kind of medications. So that's the short course that I can give you on pain medicine. Okay, lots of hands. So if I don't pick your hand, please understand it's just because I can't see very well past the 10th row. Yes, okay, here.
So I realize from what you said, you don't know what levels of serotonin people should have, but if they're taking SSRIs, which are not blocking.
Okay, the mechanism of action for SSRI antidepressants, it was a very good article on plosmedicine.org about how the antidepressants work. And actually, as opposed to being curative, the author wrote and said that it is likely that these medicines produce an abnormal state in the human brain. In fact, we know they do. That whatever these medicines do create a state that would not normally be present in their brain. And whatever benefit accrues to the person who takes them would be due to the abnormal state. Now, my view of how SSRI antidepressants work and has to do somewhat similarly with Ritalin. I really think that the SSRIs, if you give someone 20 of Prozac or 100 of Zoloft or something at the outset, it makes them very jumpy. And sort of like caffeine, sort of like the reason why you guys have Starbucks every quarter block here in Oregon. I think that probably they work somewhat out of a stimulant side effect basis. If you want to know how I think they work, and I don't know any more how they work than anybody else does. Would I absolutely say that nobody gets better who takes them because they take them? No, I wouldn't say that. Do I think that their side effects are worth their benefit? In people who are believers, who have lives which are disordered, I would say no, they're not worth the benefit. You know, fix the problems. You know, the person will get better quicker fixing the problems than they will if they continue in their problems and take medicine instead. Now, I know you're raising your hands. How much time do you need? I have 4 minutes and then I have to quit. I'm going up here next. We do not know the mechanism for why people have manic depression, and that's the only bipolar disorder that I actually view as a real disease-type problem in life. I think everything else is depression plus the side effects of taking medicine, all the bipolar twos and below. It's depression and taking medicines like that make you jittery and jumpy. Schizophrenia, I view, honestly, you can disagree with me about this, but I view it as a brain disorder that we do not understand very well. When people tell me that they're Jesus Christ or John the Baptist, I know I'm not talking to anybody who's rational. And so I look at that and say, you know, as long as you are hallucinating or psychotic, I'm not going to be able to help you much. When you stop hallucinating and being psychotic, your life is probably a wreck and you could use biblical counseling in a significant way. But I'm not going to be able to counsel you until you can make sense with me. And we don't know why people are schizophrenic. We don't know the mechanism or cause for it. Neither do we know the mechanism or cause for manic depression today. There are theories, but we do not know the cause, all right? And I'm not saying it won't be found in the future. It may be, but it is not known now. I'm going to go up here because I think she had her hand up first. Yes.
I'm wondering, how do you suggest approaching someone who comes to you on medication but won't consistently take it? So they come and they take it for a week, then
they watch it after like a week. My approach would be that I would probably tend to ignore it, one, because I don't care if they take it or not unless they're schizophrenic or manic. And for manics, I don't know that it's as big an issue because usually they don't get in trouble once every 2 or 3 years anyway. And when they do, it's fairly obvious that they're getting in trouble. So I don't know that I'd make a big issue out of it unless I had a lady once who was a bipolar one who would stay up all night and who would sweep the floors at 4 a.m. for her husband. And he wanted her to take her medicine because he wanted her to go to bed at night so that he could go to bed at night because he couldn't sleep very well if she was sweeping the floors at 4 a.m. This lady also wasn't much interested in biblical counseling. The only reason why she showed up to talk to me was because she wanted me to tell her that it was okay to quit taking her medicine. And what I finally decided for her was that I'm really not interested in biblical counseling. When you don't take the medicine, you do things which really cause a lot of trouble at home. You're a Christian. Your husband tells you to take the medicine. So what did I tell her next? Take the medicine. Yeah, why? Because her husband, who is the head of her household, told her to. And if she's a believer and she subscribes to the idea that she should be submitted to her husband, then she should take it. So that I guess that's what I'd say. One more question and then I must stop. Okay, I think it's very much hormonal, but I also think it's very much sleep deprivation. I am deadly serious about this because I've taken care of several women who've had it. And what we do at our church, I didn't tell you this, did I? Because I've said it someplace, probably the other lecture. We send in women to stay all night with the lady and take care of their baby. And between us and the doctor, that woman is going to sleep at night. For 6 weeks or 8 weeks, however long it takes. And then we also have someone there during the day to help her take care of her infant, which reduces the worry about whether or not I might hurt the child. So that's how we respond to it. If she can't sleep in spite of the fact that there are people there to take care of her child, then she needs a sleeping pill. And she may need it for a couple weeks. So between me and her physician, she's going to sleep until she gets in a normal sleep pattern. And then family and friends will help. You know, I think of that poor woman who killed her children in Oklahoma, who had 5 kids, had a new baby, and was left to her own devices to homeschool them. I think her husband should have gone to prison, frankly, and should be there today instead of married to somebody else having more kids that he didn't know how to take care of. I think her problem was all born out of sleep deprivation, for the most part. So that's what I think. And so those are the things we do with postpartum depression. We've got to stop, and we have some announcements. Thank you very much. Thank you.